Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now!
Women in Afghanistan and people in general are living in a hell, but the world never paid serious attention to their tragedy, to their sufferings, and to their terrible conditions.
Afghanistan. The Taliban have destroyed the ancient Buddhist statues of Bamiyan, but today we'll look at the living women of Afghanistan and how the Taliban came to power. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. and Kuwaiti investigating teams are being set up today to discover how a U.S. Navy warplane dropped a 500-pound bomb, killing five U.S. soldiers and a New Zealander in the Kuwaiti desert near Iraq's border. Defense sources in Kuwait said the bombing accident occurred during a nighttime live fire exercise. Kuwait's defense minister said the accident happened in training and recalled the so-called friendly fire during the Gulf War. During the 1991 war, a bungled friendly fire rocket attack by U.S. aircraft destroyed two British armored vehicles with a loss of nine soldiers. The U.S. military, along with Kuwaiti and foreign forces based in the Gulf Arab state, have set up a permanent training range at Udairi, where almost year-round exercises, codenamed Intrinsic Action, are held. Around 5,000 Americans are based in Kuwait. In Iraq, the deliberate bombing of that country by U.S. and British forces over the last decade have resulted in upwards of 400 people killed. A group of Harvard students greeted their new president yesterday with a protest calling for a more public selection process for the office and higher pay for some university employees. After a nine-month search, U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers was selected by the seven-member Harvard Corporation, the university's highest governing body. Students criticized the corporation for holding their meetings secretly. The university's charter, written in 1650, does not require input from faculty, students, or employees. Before his stint as Treasury Secretary, Summers, a former chief economist for the World Bank, has been quoted as saying, "Just between you and me, shouldn't the World Bank be encouraging more migration of the dirty industries to the LDCs, that's the least developed countries? I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. I've always thought that underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted." This was from a memo he signed several years ago. Community leader and ACT UP member Kate Sorensen was acquitted yesterday of felony charges stemming from her arrest at the Republican National Convention. Sorensen was arrested in the midst of protests focusing on the high rates of incarceration of youth, people of color, and the poor, the death penalty, and the denial of decent health care for prisoners. Following a three-day jury trial, Sorensen was found not guilty of the felonies of which she was accused, including riot, risking a catastrophe, and conspiracy. She was found guilty of one misdemeanor, criminal mischief. Sorensen was the first felony defendant to go to trial out of over 300 people facing charges related to the protests during the RNC. Singled out as a ringleader by law enforcement and held for 10 days in prison, Sorensen was originally charged with 10 felonies and 10 misdemeanors. Evidence turned over by the prosecution showed that the FBI had been following Sorensen since April of 2000. This news from Mexico City. After a triumphant arrival there, the Zapatista caravan yesterday pitched camp at local universities and turned to lobbying legislators for passage of a major Indian rights law. Members of a congressional commission met with the 24 rebel leaders to discuss details of the bill, which was written to enact a 1996 agreement between the government and the Zapatista National Liberation Army. The Indian Rights and Culture Bill had been stalled in Congress shortly after the agreement was reached with the rebels. With portable toilets, temporary electrical hookups, awning-top kitchens, and a dining hall, the rebel supporters, like the Zapatista leaders themselves, appear ready to stay for the months it might take to get the Indian bill through Congress. After international criticism, Israel's army today eased its chokehold on the town of Ramallah, the Palestinians' political and commercial center, and loosens its blockade of four other West Bank towns. But the Palestinian Information Minister denounced the changes as more cosmetic than real, saying they're aimed at deceiving the world that the closure has been lifted. The U.S. State Department had said Israeli economic pressure on the Palestinians does not enhance security but causes hardship for Palestinian families. A day earlier, a 28-year-old Palestinian intelligence officer was killed by a single shot to the chest during a protest march against one of the barricades enforcing the Ramallah closure. And finally, the governor of Sao Paulo, Brazil, announced yesterday that Latin America's largest prison and the scene of a mass rebellion last month is to be closed and replaced by three smaller jails.
Your valley is turning back to sand. Oh, the dove won't fly. Your arrogance has chained it to the ground. Yeah. But when I sleep, yeah, you call to me. Yes, we'll hear. But when I sleep, whoa, you call to me. Yes, we'll you cut through my veins. You're in my bones. You're in my blood. But you never be my home. You cut through my veins.
The Blood by Polarity One here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The fate of two ancient Buddhist monuments carved into a cliff in Afghanistan has galvanized the Muslim world against one of its own, as no other event since Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. The announcement by Afghanistan's ruling Taliban Islamic militia that it has demolished two standing Buddha statues, one believed to be the tallest of the world because they are un-Islamic idols, has provoked outrage from Muslims and those of other religions around the globe. Today, we're actually going to spend the program focusing on women of Afghanistan. But before we do that, we turn to Robert Thurman, professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University, to talk about the significance of the statues of Bamiyan. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Thurman.
Oh, hi, Amy. Thank you. Nice to be on the show.
It's good to have you with us. So what, I guess I should say, were these statues?
Yeah, well, these statues were huge representations of the Buddhist faith that benevolent beings known as Buddhas, who are something like humans, something like gods in the Mahayana Buddhist belief, were very much present and concerned with human welfare. And the whole charge of idolatry is very confused about them, because no Buddhist thinks that the statue itself is God or something. They don't. They believe these are just representations that remind human beings of the presence of benevolent and loving and wise beings. And this particular civilization that was in Afghanistan for centuries and became, because of Buddhism, became peaceful and didn't oppress people, didn't attack people. Remainder of that heritage is very, very precious to the world to remember that there were such people about 2,000 years ago in that area. And it's very unfortunate that the Taliban people are feeling so insecure and so oppressive that they're trying to wipe out anything that seems to be bigger and better than themselves.
Why do you think they were targeted by the Taliban?
Well, it's nothing new. In general, Buddhism was quite present in Afghanistan and eastern Iran and in Central Asia and all the way to Malaysia and Indonesia, actually, in the ancient time, and in India. It was like a huge presence with many, many temples and many, many what they're called stupas, which are big monuments looking like church steeples, but they're solid. They're like memorials. And then many big images like these cliff-carved ones, and there's caves in India and in China. And the people were so pleased with the ideas underlying the Buddhist imagery and felt so liberated by that, women and men and kings and commoners, that they carved a lot of these things on the cliffs and in caves and so on. And the Muslims, when they came through, tended to destroy them and demolish them, sometimes to get, if they were made of metal, it would be to get the gold and the brass and the iron that they were made of. And if they were made of stone, it was simply just to eradicate the presence of these more tolerant people who preceded them in those areas. And the tragic thing is that actually in more mainstream Islam, the more intelligent and well-educated Muslims, they didn't do that, but it was the sort of conquerors, the militant ones who were poorly educated and took too literally some of the statements in the Muslim scriptures that are against idolatry specifically, which means thinking that the idol or the object is the God, you see, rather than that the divine is some powerful, loving presence everywhere, and then you can make as many representations as you like as reminders. So these uneducated people, like the leaders of the Taliban, who are fundamentalist fanatics, they don't know that they can't make that difference, and they think they're sanctioned by God to go out around and do this destruction. But it's nothing new, Amy. They've been doing that for 1,000 years, and they really wiped out a lot of beautiful artwork. And these were some of the last big ones that remained, and it is a big tragedy. However, there's a famous verse in Shantideva, a great Indian Buddhist poet of the 8th century, who says that if people get all wound up and destroy images of the Buddha or the Bodhisattvas, don't get upset, because you just remember that the Buddhas are not upset. So you can't get too upset about this kind of ignorant thing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Robert Thurman, professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University and grandfather of Uma Thurman's baby.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Not at all. My pleasure, Amy.
Thank you.
Carry on with the great program.
Thanks. Well, the international community is reacting with sadness and anger over the destruction of the priceless Buddha statues in Afghanistan. Museums and governments around the world had hoped to save the two giant Buddhas that had been carved into the stone cliffs of Bamiyan. But despite the outcry, the Taliban completely destroyed the statues along with other smaller works. Well, now that we've talked about the Buddha statues of Bamiyan, I wanted to turn to the living people of Afghanistan. We're joined now by Sahar Saba, who is from the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She speaks to us from Islamabad, Pakistan, where she has taken refuge with her family after leaving Afghanistan. And I wanted to start out by asking you, there has been this international outcry around the statues, but I wanted to talk about the living people of Afghanistan, particularly the women and what they face today at the hands of the Taliban government.
Yeah, I think this is the point that we wanted to mention to the world, that women in Afghanistan and people in general are living in a hell, but the world never pays serious attention to their tragedy, to their sufferings, and to their terrible conditions. And as you know, the tragedy with women in Afghanistan started with the fundamentalist invasion into Afghanistan in 1992. But with coming to power of the Taliban, the situation got worse day by day. And today, believe me, there is nothing for no one in Afghanistan, especially for women. Thousands of women, they had to leave the country. And not only inside the country, but in refugees camps in Pakistan. I cannot find words to describe their horrible and terrible situation, in which conditions they are living. But unfortunately, the world they really have forgotten Afghanistan and its people. And the Taliban, of course, they are fundamentalists like their jihadi brothers who were before the Taliban in power. They are completely anti-women, anti-democracy, anti-civilization. And we are sure until they are in power, we cannot hope for any change in Afghanistan. And the world must not be surprised with Taliban's decisions in order to destroy the Buddha statues in Afghanistan. Now we want the world that at least now they should come to this point that what kind of creatures these fundamentalists are and how dangerous they are, not only for people, for women in our country, but for the countries in the regions and for the countries in all over the world.
Sahar Sabak, can you tell us about the condition of women in Afghanistan right now?
Today in Afghanistan, almost all women, they are forced to live only in their houses. They are not allowed to have any kind of job outside of their houses. And also thousands of women, they had to go to beggary or to prostitution. And there are hundreds of cases that these women, which before they were teachers or they had at least honorable jobs, but now they have lost everything. And they came to this point that the only option for them is committing suicide. And also, at some points, they really had to even sell their children, sell all their belongings. And of course, in Afghanistan, since it's not a normal country anymore, and as I said before, for people and also for women in particular, it's a real hell. All women are forced to wear burqa. All women are forced to wear the kind of clothes the Taliban have imposed for people, for women inside the country.
And what is that? Can you describe that specifically, the burqa?
The burqa is, I think, a kind of piece of clothes which have only small meshes women can see outside. And if any part of their body is exposed from burqa, the Taliban will beat them, the Taliban will insult them on streets in the public. And also the kind of shoes that women, they have to wear. These shoes must not click while women are walking. It must not have any heels. And also the color of the shoes must be not white, or at least must be black or any other dark color. And also women are not allowed to wear pants or skirts or these kind of clothing, or shaking hands with with men, or talking to men on the streets or in shops. And if women, for example, they talk to someone on the streets, the Taliban immediately will harass them and will beat them and will even they put them in to prison.
And when you say the Taliban will do this, who are they on the street when you say if they see a hand exposed or they see the wrong color shoes? Who are the Taliban?
There are mainly two kind of Talibans. One is the ordinary Taliban, which don't have most power, and the other group, which is in fact the most powerful among the Taliban, is the a group of Taliban which called the special police, religious police, the group called for promotion of virtue and prevention of vice. And these police are moving around in their special cars, and especially in most public areas where most of the people are living, or in markets. an FDC, any kind of disobey from the people, especially from the women, they immediately and suddenly, without giving them any point or any opportunity, they just started beating them and insulting them and flogging them on the streets. And these, the special police have any kind of power to do what they want. And they have, so far, there are hundreds of such cases that how they have beaten women for only very, very simple reasons. For example, a woman, since she was a widow and she didn't have anyone to go to the market and buy something for her children, she himself went, and when she went to a shop, the Talib just came after her. And not only he beat the woman, but also the shopkeeper, because both from the Taliban point of view, or they have did a big mistake. And so.
And you see this is based on religious law?
I don't think, and the people in general, not only we, but the people in Afghanistan, it's not a religious law. It's the Islam of the Taliban, a Taliban-style Islam or Taliban-style religious law, which I think is a very good and best and easy tool in the hands of Taliban and other fundamentalists.
Sahar Saba from the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan speaking to us from Islamabad, Pakistan, where she and her family have taken refuge. We'll come back to her story, and then we will also talk about how the Taliban rose to power and the role of the United States in that rise. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Sahar Saba of the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, known as RAWA. She is speaking to us from Islamabad, Pakistan, though she was born in Afghanistan. Her family has taken refuge there. You were just talking about whether the Taliban are abiding by Islamic law, and you were saying you don't see it in that way.
Because they have used Islam and religious beliefs of the people for their own interest, and they are using this. I think there is a big difference which the outside world, especially the people in Western countries, for example, in the United States, must realize that how different our religion, Islam, is from the way the Taliban used or the other fundamentalist parties they had used before. And because they know that religion is now the only way left for them to use against the people and for their own aims and objectives.
Are you religious?
In a way, I can say yes, because I belong to a Muslim country. My parents, my a family is a religious family. But since, you know, in the people in Afghanistan today, they have even started to not, we cannot say to hate Islam, but they even, because lots of crimes have committed under the name of Islam, and even very religious Muslims, they say that what the Taliban are doing or what the other fundamentalists have, that it's not the religion. And if this is Islam, then we are not Muslim.
And what about girls in school?
In fact, there is no school in Afghanistan, especially for girls, though the Taliban claim that they have opened schools for girls at least to the age of 10. But the reality is much more different from what the Taliban claims. And there are some kind of madrasas, religious schools, and mostly for girls in the mosques, not even a proper building for schools. And all the girls to the age of 10 or 8 and 9, they have to read the religious subjects only, the two in the mosque with their religious teachers. And you cannot find a school in the country with a proper education system, at least like Pakistan or like other Muslim countries. And it's, I think, again, the world must not be deceived by the Taliban's claims and that they are going to open the schools or that they are going to change their policies. Because people who are completely and naturally in their nature are against education, especially for women, how they can open schools for girls and women who cannot consider women and girls as human beings, how it's possible for them to open schools or to make schools for girls. So this is only, again, an excuse and something that the Taliban want to attract the attention of the world.
Sahar Sabah, can you tell us about your organization, RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, as well as the founder of RAWA, Mina?
RAWA, which stands for Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, is the only independent and oldest organization of women. And it was founded in 1977, under the leadership of Mina and with a few other intellectual women, aiming achieving democracy and women's rights in Afghanistan. But soon after the establishment of RAWA, our country was occupied by the Russian invaders. And RAWA, though at that time was not a very big organization, but it took active part in resistance movement. And since the situation was really bad for working politically inside the country, Mina decided to transfer most of RAWA's activities to Pakistan. In Pakistan, she started working among the refugees. She established high schools for girls and boys, a hospital under the name of Malala in Quetta, and also literacy courses for women, nurse training courses, and other healthcare mobile teams sending to refugee camps or even inside Afghanistan. But in 1987, Mina, the founder leader of RAWA, was assassinated by KGB agents with the cooperation of one of the most brutal Islamic fundamentalist parties in Pakistan, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar's party. And because the enemy was really afraid of her existence and her fight and her life. And they were finding a day to assassinate her. And finally, on 4th of February 1987, they were succeeded to kill her. But RAWA not only stopped its activities, but it continued widely and more actively struggling against the puppet regime, Russian-backed puppet regime, and also the fundamentalists at the same time. Rawa was the first and only organization in Pakistan which organized demonstration against the Russian invasion and also their puppet regime. But in 1992, when the fundamentalist parties who were created and supported by different countries in Pakistan, and in fact were imposed on our nation, Rawa decided to focus more on struggling against the fundamentalists, since it's the root cause of all the disasters and all the miseries in Afghanistan. And now Rawa is an active political and social organization, a feminist organization of women, is struggling, is active in Pakistan, mainly in refugee camps with all its social and political projects, and also inside the country.
Sahar Saba, what is your personal story? How did you end up in Pakistan?
I have left Afghanistan when I was 7 years old and during the Russian time. And with my family, like thousands of other Afghans, it was really difficult for us to live in our own village. And when I came to Pakistan, I lived in a refugee camp for 2 years. And as you know, the situation of refugees was not better from the people inside the country, because there was no access, at least to education, especially for girls and women. And my parents, they wanted me to go to school and to get education. And then fortunately, my parents know someone from Rawa, and then they talked to Rawa, and then after that, they decided to send me and some other girls in my family to Rawa School, which at that time was in Quetta. And since last 10 years, I'm working with Rawa in different fields of Rawa. Sometimes I'm teacher in a school, in a refugee camp. Sometimes I'm working in publication and cultural committee. And right now I'm a member of Foreign Affairs Committee of Rawa, and also cultural committee.
How in Afghanistan do women express opposition?
Working inside the country means you have to take a great risk. And for Rawa, as a women organization, it's really difficult. And for example, establishing or making a literacy course or a home-based class will take even months for us to organize. Or working among the women, giving them awareness, going to their houses, or documenting human rights, which is our main work inside the country. Several times we have examples that how our male supporters, how our members, they faced very serious problems, but fortunately somehow they managed to escape from the Taliban's and from their other agents. And women, in different ways, they are trying to organize themselves, especially those women who were educated before, who were teachers, who had some kind of jobs. Even they themselves, with their own initiatives, they have made some home-based classes, literacy courses, or other income projects. And through different ways, they are in contact with each other and trying that the Taliban and other fundamentalists must not know about them. There is some kind of solidarity and collaboration among the people in general, and especially among the women.
Sahar, do you face threats in Pakistan, in Islamabad, where you are, after all, the founding member of your organization, Rawa? She was assassinated in Pakistan.
Yeah. I think in Pakistan, yes, it's not easy for us to work, and we have to face a lot of security problems, very serious problems, and it's not only from the Taliban and other fundamentalists who even now have very great and influence in Pakistan and have power, what they want they can do, but also unfortunately from the government of Pakistan and from certain agencies, especially in the government of Pakistan. We are followed by them, and we are under even our phone, our emails and everything under their control, and we are not allowed to work as we want. And even though all our activities in Pakistan are according to the constitutional law of this country, of course we have condemned the government of Pakistan since the beginning of the war for supporting the fundamentalist parties and now for the recognition of Taliban as a legitimate government. You know, our demonstration was attacked recently in December 10th, and tens of our members, they got serious injuries by the police of Pakistan and also the fundamentalists.
What risk are you taking just by having this conversation?
There may be a lot of possibilities because, as I told you, that our phones, conversations, our other contacts are under control. So there is no doubt. Maybe this is also can be not maybe tomorrow, but or this moment, but in the long term, we will face the problems. It can create problems, but of course, it's not important for us anymore, because for us, important is that the world at least can hear our voice on behalf of the women, suffered women of Afghanistan and the people of Afghanistan. And we expect anything at any moment. And this is what again, make a big difference, gap between us and others. Doing all this work and activities needs giving, again, sacrifices, giving your life. And it's not only in words, because we have learned from our leaders. She just showed it in giving her life. She was only 30 years old. If she was alive, she could play a very, very important role in the movement of women in Afghanistan.
What role has the United States played in the strength of the Taliban?
Unfortunately, the United States was one of the countries that brought the not only the Taliban, but also the fundamentalists. The point we even, at the beginning of the war, 20 years ago, we warned the United States and other countries that how dangerous it will be giving support to the fundamentalists, such as Gulbuddin Rabbani, Saif Khalili, and others. And today, after 20 years, United States and other countries and also people, our people see that how correct and how right we were. But the United States, I think, is one of the countries which is responsible for today's Afghanistan. And I think it's time for the government of United States to apologize the people of Afghanistan for what she did during the resistance war. And for their own, not only America, but all the countries which are involved in Afghanistan's affairs, I think they really committed a big mistake. In a way, we can say they have supported the most brutal and misogynist criminals in our country. And the reason that today Afghanistan turned into a big center of terrorists is only and only because of the financial and military support and political support of these countries. And these countries, they didn't take care of a nation, what's happening to a nation, but for their own economic and political interest. They supplied arms, they supplied everything to these fundamentalists and ordered them to do and to turn Afghanistan to a destroyed country.
And what are they doing today? What is the United States government doing today?
Today, I think we don't see any important change in the policy of the United States. The United States really wanted or wants to do something for the betterment of the situation in Afghanistan, it can play a very important role. And unfortunately, the only disagreement of United States with the Taliban was the issue of Osama bin Laden, the infamous terrorist, which himself was created and supported by the United States, and also through the United Nations, and putting pressure on the other countries such as Pakistan or Saudi Arabia and other countries, United States is can do a lot, but unfortunately, again, for its own political and economic interest, it cannot do and it cannot take at least a practical step. We have several times heard from Madam Hillary Clinton or even Clinton, Mr. Clinton himself, that they have condemned the Taliban's policies, but it's not enough. And it's time to take practical steps, which unfortunately the government of the United States is not have not taken so far.
We see a lot of petitions online supporting women of Afghanistan, condemning the Taliban's treatment of women. And I assume you're getting thousands of signatures, but what does it mean? What good does it do?
I think, first of all, I must point out this, that for us, for Rawa, and even for the people in Afghanistan, there is a big difference between the governments of the countries which are involved in Afghanistan and the people of those countries, especially of the United States. And we have gotten their warm sympathy and support during the Russian invasion and then now. And the United States is one of the countries that we have a lot of great supporters there. But I think only sending their sympathy or their solidarity through signing petitions or just by words are not enough. They also, as people, as an individuals, or as the people, as a nation, they can put pressure on their government to stop this human rights tragedy in our country.
Sahar Saba from the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, known as RAWA, speaking to us from Islamabad, Pakistan. And if you would like to go to their website, you can go to www.rawa.org. When we come back, we'll be joined by two people to further talk about the U.S. role in the rise of the Taliban and the Mujahideen. We'll also talk about Osama bin Laden and the sanctions against Afghanistan. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at what's happening in Afghanistan today, when the Taliban seized control of the Afghan capital, Kabul, in 1996, very few people knew anything about the movement. It's perhaps one of the most secretive movements in the world today, with the exception of the Khmer Rouge of Cambodia. A ban on photography and television means no one knows what its leaders look like. Yet the Taliban and its interpretation of the Sharia law, which leads it to prevent girls from attending school and women from working, has grabbed headlines around the world. Some of the responsibility for the religious and political upheaval in Afghanistan today can be traced to U.S. intervention in the country. After the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and took control, it became a battleground for East-West global disputes. The CIA mounted the largest ever operation in Afghanistan, including training and arming militant anti-Soviet groups with sophisticated weapons. But in addition to being anti-Soviet, the Mujahideen were anti-West in general and anti-American in particular. With the defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan, many of the Mujahideen turned their antagonism westward. Osama bin Laden was only one of those who received CIA training and later turned that expertise against Washington. We're joined right now by Sonali Kolkatkar on the board of directors for the Afghan Women's Mission, speaking to us from California. And Jim Ingalls, who is author of a recent article in Z Magazine called Smart Sanctions on Afghanistan, also speaking to us from Pasadena. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Sonali Kolkatkar, can you start off by telling us specifically, taking off on what Sahar Sabah was saying about U.S. Involvement in Afghanistan and how it supported the Taliban and the Mujahideen?
Yes. Hi, Amy. Yes, I'd like to mention very strongly that what was happening inside Afghanistan was really fueled by outside pressures and countries such as the United States. One of the most indicative factors was the CIA's knowledge of the type of men that they were funding. These Mujahideen warriors or soldiers of God were groups of men, seven different factions of men, that were funded by the CIA, and one of them specifically that Sahar Sabah mentioned, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, was well known for throwing acid in the faces of women who didn't cover themselves. And this was a fact known by the CIA, that they were very anti-women leaders. And in the CIA's own words, these men were dictatorship material, these men were fascist. And that didn't prevent the CIA from helping these men, arming them to the hilt, pouring about $3 billion of aid, and setting up training camps inside Pakistan to stave off the Soviet invasion, and really setting the stage for a future fundamentalist state inside Afghanistan. And of course, after the Soviet invasion, the Mujahideen groups began turning on themselves and fighting each other. Vying for power, because there was sort of a vacuum left behind. Even though there was a government set up in Afghanistan, the ones with the real power and the arms were the Mujahideen, who had been supplied arms by the United States. And during this period, which is known as the Civil War, after the Soviet Union pulled out, some of the most worst atrocities took place upon the civilian population of Afghanistan. I mean, they literally rocket-shelled Kabul and destroyed buildings and killed several thousands of people. The situation for women was also incredibly horrible at this time. Even though there weren't any specific laws requiring that women stay at home, women effectively stayed at home for their own safety. And there have been documented numerous crimes against women, such as rape and torture. So the stage was really set in 1996 in terms of the country being really devastated and really not having any infrastructure and the people themselves not having much strength left to resist when the Taliban appeared on the scene and took over Kabul. And in fact, at first, the population of Afghanistan was relieved, thinking that finally there might be a force that might stabilize the country and provide it with a much-needed structure and stability. Of course, they were to soon find out that the Taliban imposed an even worse brand of Islam than the Mujahideen claimed, which was to put into law what Sahar was saying in terms of confining women to their homes and not allowing them access to health and education, and effectively really reducing their ability to have a decent life.
Jim Engels, you wrote the piece in Z Magazine's Smart Sanctions on Afghanistan. Can you talk about the sanctions that have been imposed by the UN Security Council and also where Osama bin Laden fits into this?
Yes, hi, Amy.
Hi.
Well, the sanctions were imposed at the end of last year in December by the UN Security Council. They were backed mainly by the United States, Russia, India, Kyrgyzstan. These countries are all supporting the United Front, which is the former Mujahideen factions that are still holding on to a piece of territory in the north of Afghanistan. The sanctions were imposed on the Taliban regime, ostensibly to limit their access to military equipment and essentially to bolster the United Front in their fight against the Taliban. Which, as we've just heard, that these groups of people are also fundamentalists who would probably be no different in power. The sanctions were stated to be a single-purpose resolution aimed at terrorism by the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And as such, they don't deal with the horrible humanitarian situation in Afghanistan, the refugee crisis, the drought, the hunger. Afghanistan is one of the top three most hungry countries in the world. And these, therefore, the sanctions are essentially just targeting terrorism, supposedly. In fact, they're just targeting terrorism in name, not in in actuality. On Osama bin Laden, that is, he is the reason why the sanctions have been imposed, supposedly to pressure the Taliban to give up Osama bin Laden, who they're harboring. As Sonali mentioned, bin Laden was a Saudi businessman who helped the U.S. fund the Mujahideen during the 1980s. Since then, he's shown his anti-American nature and has criticized the U.S. Involvement in Saudi Arabia. He's criticized the presence of U.S. military bases in Saudi Arabia, which started during the Gulf War. And he's trying to get the U.S. out of Saudi Arabia, and there's a growing movement there to do that.
Didn't former President Bush, the Bush family, have a business relationship with the bin Laden family?
I believe so. The bin Laden's family bin Laden was mainly a construction tycoon. They've had incredibly deep dealings with the Saudi government. A lot of Saudi government buildings have been funded, and the construction of them has been done by the bin Laden family.
Where does oil fit into this, Dr. Engels?
Well, basically Afghanistan is to the south of the Caspian Sea, which is the latest and the last great oil reserve, considered a great prize by many countries, including the United States. Russia, who used to basically own that land as the Soviet Union, first as the Russian Empire, then as the Soviet Union, all of the countries of the Caspian region, or most of them, were part of the Soviet Union. And this prize has yet to be exploited in its fullest by the countries of the region. The Soviet Union had essentially underexploited it because they wanted their own oil reserves in Siberia, the Russian reserves, to be the main source of oil. Now it's coming out. All the countries in the region, as well as the U.S., are trying to get that oil and trying to get control of it, because control of that oil will essentially enable whoever has it to control a lot of the world's oil market for the future.
Do you think that's why the sanctions have been imposed?
I'm not sure exactly if that is the only reason. I'm sure that's part of the reason. Afghanistan lies in a kind of a crucial location between Iran and Pakistan. One of the possible routes for oil and gas from Caspian countries is through Afghanistan. The U.S. wants a diverse, quote-unquote diverse, means of getting the oil out, as opposed to just getting it out through the traditional routes through Russia, which means Russia would control them. They want to have some of the control, at least some of the control, and at least they don't want only one country to have that control.
So, Nali Khatkar, what about the refugees? A massive refugee problem.
Yes, this is a problem that is really underreported in the U.S. mainstream news today. And Afghanistan really has the world's largest refugee population, a fact that's not really well known. And they're the largest if you don't count Palestinians as refugees. But about 2.6 million of 3 million refugees live in Pakistan today. And in the last 4 months alone, of course, these 2.6 million have been coming over the last decade, but in the last 4 months alone, the official figure, according to the UN, has been over 150,000 refugees have left Afghanistan to flee into Pakistan. The real number is quite well larger than that, maybe double. And it's a really incredibly terrible situation because they're escaping not only the worst drought in 30 years, not only a terrible landmine infestation and the bitter winter, but of course they're escaping the fighting between the Taliban and the United Front inside Afghanistan, which has a lot of collateral damage and has, caught a lot of civilians in the crossfire. And they're in a couple of camps, or two or three camps, inside the border of Pakistan. Hundreds of thousands of these refugees who have absolutely no food, water, no access to any kind of sanitation, no warm clothing in the bitter winter. Many tens of them have died from the cold, mostly children. And the tragedy of it all is that the Pakistani government right now is restricting access to these refugee camps, restricting access of relief agencies to the refugee camps, because the Pakistani government doesn't want to recognize them as official refugees, because they feel that if these refugees were to get access to food and water, that it would just encourage more to come across the border. So it's a terrible tragedy, and it's a really, really emergency situation right now.
What do you think is the most important thing the United States could do right now, given its role in the past with bringing those to power that are in power right now in Afghanistan?
Well, I think that if the United States was really serious about undoing some of the damage it has done, the first thing it would do is either drop the sanctions or at least extend the sanctions to include the United Front, because the one-sidedness of the sanctions is really what keeps the fighting going, or will keep the fighting going, because right now they're only aimed at the Taliban and not at the United Front. And so that kind of ensures that one side has an advantage. However, the sanctions themselves are pretty difficult to enforce. But the other thing would be to, reparations to the civilian population of Afghanistan for the damage that was wreaked by U.S. money, and to encourage its allies who it has influence over, such as Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, to immediately withdraw recognition of the Taliban and to hold the Taliban accountable. I mean, Pakistan has the deepest ties with the Taliban, and many believe that are responsible for the Taliban.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Sonali Kolhatkar, on the board of directors for the Afghan Women's Mission, that website, afghanwomensmission.org, and Jim Ingalls, author of the recent article in Z Magazine, Smart Sanctions on Afghanistan. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us by email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!